Tuesday, February 16th, 2410. When Juniper woke up, the first thought that crossed her mind was, I should feel like a truck hit me. And I don't. Cautiously, she opened her eyes, sat up, and looked around. She was in an unfamiliar bed, with what looked like a bearskin for a comforter, in a completely unfamiliar room. The curtains were drawn across the room's single window. She could just make out daylight through them. And two doors. One stood open, and she could see a bathroom beyond it. The other was closed. Pulling the covers back, she carefully ran her fingers over her right ankle. It was slightly stiff, with a few faded bruises over the bones. Cautiously, she put the foot she was sure she'd broken down on the ground, and tested putting weight on it. When it didn't send shrieking orders to her brain that what she was doing was a bad idea, she made a beeline for the bathroom. As she attended to her morning ablutions, she began to wonder exactly where she was, who had tended her, and what was going to happen next. Half an hour later, with clean hair and clean teeth, and feeling considerably more optimistic, if no less bemused, she emerged from the bathroom, swathed in a couple of towels. Good morning, Junichan, Caitlin said, turning away from the window where the curtains had been pulled back. Feel better? Juniper blinked several times as she tried to pull her scattered thoughts together. Caitlin's here. That means wherever I am, somebody knew who I was. Hastily, she bowed. Good morning, Sensei. Yes. Caitlin nodded at the room's sole chair. Clothes. Then, report. Anne finished pulling herself out of her mental fog. I guess questions wait until after I answer Sensei's, she thought firmly, discarded her towel, and sorted through the unfamiliar black clothing. It was definitely tailored for someone with hips, but it certainly wasn't hers, and something about it seemed familiar. She couldn't quite place it. When she'd finished belting the tunic on, she sat down on the bed and began teasing tangles out of her wet hair. While carefully unpicking the knots with her fingers, she gave Caitlin as thorough a synopsis of the previous day's events as she could, starting with being summoned from the brownstone. For the first part of it, her sensei remained largely impassive, but when Juniper recounted Toga and Sayanji's conversation before she had stepped in to break it up, Caitlin's eyes narrowed. Anne described the duel with Sayanji, mentioned that he hadn't been wearing his lens, but left out that she knew where it was, and did her best to remain true to the rather surreal conversation she'd had with him throughout. When she finished, Caitlin nodded and said, "Good," but didn't elucidate further. Anne went on to recount the confrontation with Toga, the unleashing of the spectral dragon upon the castle, and the subsequent duel and defeat of the erstwhile president of the student council. Then she waited while Caitlin digested the fact that her younger apprentice was claiming to have used the Hyaken no Arashi in combat. "What is it about Sephiro and my apprentices?" Caitlin mused. "That's where Kyuichi-kun first used it, too." She shook her head. "Well done. What did you do about the dragon?" "Well, Gunnar told me how to initiate a formal duel in Asgard, so I tried that. It worked." Here, Anne rubbed at her scalp gently. She'd lost a lot of frizzy hair in the shower. "And that's where I got most of my beating. It kept spitting lightning at me, and since I didn't have my pistol, I couldn't just shoot it." "You didn't bring that with you, did you?" she asked hopefully. Caitlin smiled and shook her head. "I'll send someone to get it. Go on." Anne digested this, then mentally shrugged. "I did a jump attack against it as it came down for another pass, landed badly, and broke my ankle. Or thought I did. I couldn't stand up, anyway. So I sat and waited for it to come down. It blasted me again, and I caught it in the corner of the mouth and tore its side open. Then it exploded, and about then I decided it was probably about the right time to take a nap. I guess that's when Master Clef found me. Or was it Kanai? Her sensei smiled again, a little enigmatically, and said, "No. Balder Goldenlight and Frey Lightwalker found you. They are probably going to ask you the same questions I am." Frey wasn't sure what to make of you, but Balder recognized your Bokuto, so he sent someone to get Anthy. I came instead. Anne stared at her teacher, utterly without words. Caitlin chuckled softly and said, "Pull yourself together, Junichan. You didn't think anything could make that much noise in the roots of the world tree and not get noticed, did you?" Mutely, Anne shook her head, then nodded, then put her face in her hands and took a couple of deep, slow breaths. When she finally got the charging train wreck of her thoughts under control, she said, "I hadn't really thought about it." "That's all right. You didn't have much time to. I expect the Valkyrie have told Balder that you're awake, though, so we should get some breakfast before Frey comes and demands to know what happened." Anne was still trying to work through the muddle of having been found by a couple of gods on the dueling platform, but she recognized the general good sense that was being proposed to her. Talking to the gods on an empty stomach is probably a bad idea, yeah. Then she frowned, realizing Frey had been named. Frey, who had arranged for the emergency last summer that recalled Gunnar. She looked around. "Where did they put my Bokuto?" That made Caitlin nod approvingly. "Good instincts, Junichan. I don't know, but I suspect they'll be quick to give it back after you tell them what happened. You've done them a service." Juniper narrowed her eyes at that, and was about to reply when Corwin poked his head around the door. "Aaron said you were awake. Want breakfast?" Caitlin nodded. "I'd just suggested it," she said. She dug around in the closet for a few seconds and came up with a couple of fur-lined jackets, one of which she handed to Anne. Then, gesturing for the girl to precede her, she shepherded her student out of the building and out into the city beyond the window. The weather was chilly, but not bone-achingly cold, and though there was snow along the edges of some of the roofs, it had been cleared from the streets. These were paved in blue-black brick and had curbs of gold-shot marble. They held relatively few cars. Most of the traffic was on foot, on the wide sidewalks flanking the broad boulevards. And in that traffic were represented a number of different races, many of them human-looking to Anne's eyes, and some of them not. During her 2 years on the run, Anne had been exposed to huge numbers of non-human races, many of them with an axe to grind and a chip on their shoulder about humans. She'd seen people dressed in all different kinds of clothing, buildings of the prefab variety or the ones that were constructed over the course of generations and that evolved into something completely different from what they'd originally been. She'd never been any place that felt like this, however. Most of the people on the street radiated a sense of good cheer that she could almost taste. They seemed to come from all walks of life, from any point in history that she could think of, and yet passed each other without a second glance, aside from the occasional nod of greeting. The courtesy even extended beyond racial boundaries, and nobody seemed to give it a second thought. It was astonishing enough that she almost forgot that Caitlin had said she'd been found unconscious by two deities. Almost. But between that revelation, the weirdly courteous way people were behaving, and the ongoing déjà vu that kept assaulting her, Corwin had to steer her through the crowds on what amounted to autopilot. Caitlin said nothing, just took in the sights with a private smile that grew a little wider every time she looked at her bemused apprentice. They arrived at the base of a rather tall tower, with an amusing wooden placard of a round plate with a stack of pancakes on it hanging over the entrance, and Corwin shepherded his sister and her apprentice inside. The hostess waiting just inside gave Corwin a cheery smile. She was wearing what looked like a French peasant's outfit from a storybook, Anne noticed distractedly. "Good morning, Lord Corwin," she said. "We haven't seen you in a while, but enjoying your breakfasts elsewhere?" "What can I say, Elise?" he answered cheerfully. "I'll be a married man soon. I don't get out as much as I used to. Hey, is there a table on the balcony free? This is Anne's first trip to the Golden City." The girl dimpled at Corwin and said, "For you? Of course." She led them up several flights of stairs to an open-air balcony with several tables on it. Despite being open to the sky, the balcony wasn't cold, something Anne wasn't in a frame of mind to give really deep consideration just now. The table closest to the golden railing at the balcony's edge didn't have anybody sitting at it, just a selection of syrupy plates and dirty silverware that their hostess cleared off quickly. She put menus down on the table, dimpled at Corwin again, and said, "Catriona will be up to take your order in a moment, my lord." As she was saying this, Anne walked, half aware that she was doing so, to the railing and stared out at a view of a spectacularly beautiful city. The feeling of déjà vu got stronger as she stared out. It was not New Avalon, though the buildings reached for the cerulean sky in a similar vaulting, soaring manner. They were mostly of a different style, and the city before her was older, immensely older, than New Avalon. She could feel that looking at it, with its golden and silver spires and its sea of lower, blue-tile-roofed buildings surrounding the bases of the towers. It almost felt as if New Avalon was an echo of this city, an imperfect copy. The building in the center of all this was a vast and gleaming edifice that seemed to have been cast in a single gigantic piece out of gold, part fairy-tale castle, part Art Deco skyscraper, with a brilliant beam of pure white light arrowing up into the sky from its tallest spire. Anne leaned against the rail, so overwhelmed by the view that she didn't even notice it appeared to be made of wrought gold, her eyes wide. Suddenly a movement caught her eye, a shape, dark green against the brilliant blue of the sky, arced past that beam of light, circling around it with an almost whimsical air, before winging over and going on its way uptown. Now that she noticed it, Anne realized that there were several flying objects going this way and that above the city. A couple were dirigibles, but the others... Anne drew in a breath as she realized what they were. It was a city out of time, with echoes of a million storybook places, and it had dragons plying the skies above it. The shadow of a fluffy white cloud crawled across the rooftops below, and as it passed away from one long, low building, a blaze of yellow-white light dazzled her. The hall, whatever it was, had a roof made of gold. That was the last piece, and as it clicked into place, Anne realized with a flash of insight why she knew this city. After looking at the city until she thought her brain would burst if she tried to dredge one more detail out of her long, dusty memories and compare it with what lay before her, Anne turned to Corwin and Caitlin with the wonder still written large on her face. They were sitting back in the wrought iron chairs at the little cafe table, with several plates of pancakes set out in front of them. Both of them were smiling. "Like it?" Corwin asked. "It's incredible," she breathed. "I never thought..." She paused, collecting her thoughts, then stepped nearer so that what she had to say next would be only for his ears. "As a little girl, I dreamed of this city, but I never thought it was real." Corwin's smile deepened, taking on an air of satisfaction, as if she'd just told him something that confirmed a suspicion he'd had. "That's a phenomenon that's gotten rarer and rarer over the last few centuries," he told her. "As Midgard gets more and more technological, and in many ways less and less spiritual, the number of children who dream of this place dwindles. But they never quite stop coming." All the true children of magic dream of this city, Anne. But I'm not dreaming this time, she said, and Corwin shook his head, grinning. Where are we? Anne asked, but in her heart she already knew the answer, had known it since Corwin had smiled knowingly at her wonder. Heaven, Corwin replied, gesturing grandly to the vista before them. Welcome to Asgard. The pancakes are going cold, Caitlin observed cheerfully. That broke the mood, and Anne laughed for the first time that morning and sat down to have breakfast. They weren't quite as good as Utrina's blueberry pancakes, but as she finished off her plate of them, she decided that they would definitely do. Otori Institute, Orifus. Toga Kiryu, late student council president of Otori Academy and an exceedingly minor figure in the infernal circles of Muspelheim, was having a very bad day. Since his translation from damned soul to minor demon, having his fleshly form killed outside the pit wasn't exactly a season-ending injury, but it was painful all the same, and the manner in which it had happened this time had been humiliating. Especially when he came to see Nanami sitting watch over him with a book, and that infuriating little sardonic smile of hers. She'd asked him if he'd enjoyed being street pizza, and had he found any cute girls to seduce while he'd been back in Sephiro. He'd been annoyed when he woke up. That simple little phrase had sent him straight into the boiling with rage category. The only satisfaction he'd had yet today was the frantic way the younger students were getting out of his way as he strode down a black marble corridor, turned a corner, and slammed a tall pair of double doors open on his way into the room beyond. That room proved to be an office, its high, vaulted ceiling invisible in the gloom above, with peaked stained-glass windows providing a pleasant view of the courtyard of the new Otori Institute. Bookshelves lined the walls, except for the place along one side where a giant map of Sephiro hung in a heavy, carved wood frame. In front of the windows bulked the squat shape of a wide, heavy black desk, behind which was the high back of a leather chair, its occupant having turned to look out the windows. "You failed," said a matter-of-fact voice from that chair. "No thanks to you," Toga snarled. "You told me that Trinity was otherwise occupied. You told me they wouldn't be able to thwart me." The chair swiveled slowly around, and Akio Otori regarded Toga with a calmly disdainful look. "And they didn't," he said dismissively. "You told me the platform would be undefended if I could penetrate the forest," Toga went on angrily. Behind him, Nanami trotted into the room, having had to run to catch up to her brother's furious strides. "Indeed?" asked Akio with a tone of very mild interest. Toga slammed his hand down on the desk and roared, "Again, you lied to me!" Akio looked up at his angry underling, hooded his eyes, and murmured, "Again you believed me. Which of us does that make the fool?" Toga stared down at him, face almost flushed enough to blend away his scarlet marks, and could not reply. After a moment, Akio sighed as if bored. "I can see there I will get nothing useful out of you today, either. Not even information. Nanami," he added to the blonde, "your brother is in a temper. Find someone for him to work it off with." Nanami looked equally bored. "With pleasure, Lord Akio," she said in a truly perfunctory tone of voice, and, taking Toga's arm, pulled him insistently from the room. Akio watched them go, then smiled softly to himself and turned back to regard the courtyard again. He hadn't truly expected the attack on the castle to work. It was another feint, to see what resources the Rose Knight and her followers could bring to bear and to set them off balance again. This time it had brought a new player to light. Good. He would have to learn about this girl. He got up from his desk and went in search of Kyuichi Sionji. Asgard. After breakfast, Caitlin headed back to Midgard to tell Utena and Anthy what had happened, and Corwin left Anne in a conference room while he went to make some calls. While he was out, Anne's subconscious managed to get herself worked into a state of nervous anticipation. Thoughts of who she was going to meet, combined with the knowledge of where she was, combined to play havoc on her muddled teenage self-conscious, and the general feelings of inadequacy that occasionally cropped up when she found herself compared to Utena, Caitlin, or any number of other female heroes she'd met from time to time. Corwin returned briefly to ask if she wanted a cup of coffee. He gave her a sympathetic smile when she declined, knowing the caffeine would just make her jumpier than ever. As he left, she folded herself up, cross-legged on one of the conference room chairs, and started concentrating on her breathing. The meditation exercises that had been her first introduction to the Katsujin Kenryu were old friends by now, and helped her put in perspective the weirdnesses of the last 24 hours. When a hand touched her arm and she opened her eyes, she didn't feel like she was about to vibrate to pieces anymore. "You okay?" Corwin asked. Anne nodded mutely and looked across the table to see two men, one with pointy ears and a serious mien to his expression, and the other with burnished blonde hair and an air about him that made the part of her that had fallen in love with the forest behind 1140 Wildwood Road purr contentedly. Slung across the back of the blonde man's chair was Toneri Koken. "Well, Miss Cross," said the man with pointy ears, "I'm Frey Lightwalker. One of my duties is the defense of Asgard against the forces of the Pit. Given where we found you and who you associate with," he glanced at Corwin and gave him a little half nod, "it seems unlikely that you were responsible for the destruction we discovered yesterday in the roots of the World Tree. In fact, Corwin suspects that you're part of the reason the damage was as localized as it was." "I'm here because my duties include the defense of the World Tree," the other said. He paused, then smiled at her, and Anne felt a little knot of tension unclench between her shoulders. "We haven't been introduced. I'm Baldur Goldenlight, Anne. Please tell us what happened to you yesterday," he asked. Then he added with a smile, "And for the sake of Frey's duties, don't leave anything out." Anne nodded soberly, nibbled on her lip, and began with her arrival on the Tenjo Academy bell tower. "And it exploded, and my adrenaline crashed," she finished, "and I decided that it was probably about the right time to lie down." She fidgeted with the end of her braid. "I remember hearing somebody say something just before I fell over, though." Baldur smiled cheerfully. "Arriving on the scene just as you fell over was rather startling," he agreed. "We were expecting to arrive in the middle of a fight, not after it, given the amount of noise that was coming up through the roots." "The Svartelves didn't even object to us coming through," Frey added, sounding darkly amused. "They're one of the few groups in creation who don't like you, Baldur. And all they said was, 'Be our guest,' when we told them we were coming through." "Dark elves don't much care for the light of the sun," Baldur agreed. "Well, now we know what happened. The question is, how did that demon manage to empower one of the spawn of Nidhoggr sufficiently to allow it to do so much damage to the roots of the World Tree in so short a time?" "So it normally wouldn't be able to cause that much havoc?" Anne asked, certain enough now that nobody was angry at her to actually ask questions. Baldur shook his head. "One of the signs of the Ragnarok, in addition to my death," here he looked rueful, "is Nidhoggr finally chewing through the roots of the tree and killing it. But while its spawn do some small amount of damage to the tree, their destruction manifests as a more dispersed form of entropy. Mold and rot, or smaller parasites that chew on the roots. All the stuff that any normal gardener would spray for, Anne said, then blinked. Is that what the myths mean when they say the Norns sprinkle the water from the well on the tree? They're spraying for bugs? Balder looked amused. That's an interpretation that I hadn't heard before, he said, grinning. I will have to tell Beldandi that one. I suspect it will amuse her. But somehow that demon found a way to make that particular spawn nearly as powerful as Nidhoggr itself, Frey said grimly. That is not good. Corwin shook his head. Toga's not smart enough to pull something like that off on his own, he said. One will get you 10 that Akio Otori is really behind this. You know, he was raised by Surtur as a demon, and he was a fairly potent mage before his death. Between his connection with Sephiro and the fact that he's now highly ranked in Muspelheim, he's probably got the access he needs to the records of all the demons' encounters with Nidhoggr, and the magical knowledge he needs to make its spawn just as deadly as the primal worm. Unfortunately, my agents in the pit haven't been able to tell me much about what Otori is doing. Frey's expression was sour with disgust. He's vanished from the demonic social scene, so to speak, since he took the worst of his clash with the Midgard Knight. We assume he's secluded himself in one of the farthest reaches. I haven't been able to get anyone into his domain. The only real information I have comes from you and your father, Corwin, and that's weeks old at this point. It's not enough to plan a defense with. Anne nibbled on her lip. Corwin, have you asked Master Clef if he found Sionji in the forest? No such luck, Corwin said, shaking his head. While you were sleeping, I asked Clef to tell me what he did know, and there wasn't anything foreign left in the Forest of Secrets once you'd dealt with the worm. There wasn't even a trace of the spell that made the trees sick. So either he got up and left under his own power, or something from the pit came and retrieved him. Then, if Sionji is down there with Toga, she said slowly, when he gets out, he may know what they're doing. There was a pause, and then Frey said dubiously, Do you think we can trust him? Anne nodded without hesitation, feeling heartened by the "we" in Frey's statement. He left me that opening deliberately. He didn't want to win. He wanted me to stop Toga. But he couldn't just let me by. I could feel his frustration every time I missed an opening. Whatever he's doing down there, it's not actually helping Akio. Corwin sighed. I wish he'd told someone what the hell he was trying to do. Ah, that answers that question, then. Frey sighed. So nobody knows when, or really if, he's planning on coming out. Not unless he told Caitlin, Corwin said. Wakab has been grousing about him not being around since just after New Year's. Anne shook his head. Sensei wasn't too pleased to hear where he'd gone when I told her this morning. We can't afford to wait for him, then. Frey sat back, apparently thinking. Corwin, if you can think of anyone you want to help analyze the container Toga opened on the platform, let me know. I'm going to put together a team to go over that and look through the records in the library to see if there are any clues there. And I'll step up my efforts to get someone into Otori's organization. Corwin nodded. I'll think about it and get back to you. In the meantime, it sounds like I'm going to have to revive the Order of the Ash Knight, Balder said, sounding more bemused than anything else. I haven't heard of that one, Corwin said. Balder chuckled. Not surprising, given that the World Engine has superseded much of what the World Tree once stood for. The Ash Knights are defenders of the World Tree, rather than of the engine itself. rather more mystical than is common in Asgard today. Your mother's a member. Mom's a member of everything. Corwin rolled his eyes. No doubt, Frey said, sounding like a man who wanted badly to get out of a meeting and on with his life. Corwin, you'll secure the access to your dueling platform. I'd like to avoid a repeat performance. Next time, your mage may not be able to get competent help so quickly. I'll see to it, Corwin agreed. I'm not sure how, but I'll figure something out. Frey looked back at Anne. Thank you for your prompt action, Miss Cross. He pushed the notes he'd taken together in front of him, flipped the folder closed. You stopped cold what could otherwise have been a very demoralizing situation for Asgard, and have thwarted the agents of Muspelheim. He paused, looked at Baldur and Corwin, and an odd sort of half-smile played across his face. I'm sure Corwin can think of a more appropriate reward than I can, so I will leave you with my thanks and will make the best use I can of what you've told me. With that rather odd statement, he left the room and left Anne looking puzzled. Corwin took one look at her face and smothered a laugh. That is the guy who yanked you and Gunnar back here last summer, isn't it? She asked finally. He's gotten better since then, Corwin said, still sounding amused. Baldur smiled. He's not used to having to say thank you to mortals, Anne, he said, shifting his weight and taking Teneri Kokan off the back of the chair he was in. I suspect he thinks that his needing to say thank you is an indication that he's done his job poorly. I guess I can see that, Anne said pensively. You, however, have earned the right to carry a weapon of Yggdrasil, Baldur said, offering the Bokuto out to her with both hands. Though it may have been a gift, you have more than repaid the trust in your potential. I am glad that Lady Anthe asked me for this last summer. Anne blushed, feeling both pleased and slightly embarrassed at the same time, but she reclaimed her Bokuto and slung it back in its accustomed place over her shoulder. Corwin saw her shoulders relax after a moment and grinned. Feel better? She gave him a crooked smile. Yeah. I don't much like being unarmed anymore. He agreed. I can see that. If you'll excuse us, Baldur, Caitlin did ask me to see that something got done about that particular problem. The sun god smiled and gestured to the door as Anne blinked at Corwin. What? Come on, Corwin said with a conspiratorial grin. So, what is with him anyway? Anne asked once they were outside. First thing, he's a total freak and hauls you home, and now he's thanking me for fighting off demons and isn't even looking down his nose at me. Is it just because I'm not dating you or something? Corwin gave a slightly dark chuckle. It's a little more complicated than that, but you're closer than you probably think. Anne looked mildly confused. I was dating Gunnar, though. Should I be offended for her or not? Oh. No, I doubt that even crossed his mind, Corwin said. You guys were just caught in the middle. That whole thing with the recall was aimed at a very specific target by someone with an axe to grind. What I didn't realize at the time was that that someone wasn't actually Frey. That just made Anne more confused. Okay, she said after a few moments. I take it you were the target, at least. Have I mentioned I really, really hate politics? Politics are evil. This was only political in the loosest sense. And no, actually, I wasn't the target. Or at least not the main one. Corwin ran a hand over his disordered black hair, then sighed. Maybe I should start over. See, Frey did call for the alert. That's his prerogative as god of security. But it wasn't his idea, it was his sister's. Okay, that would be Freya, right? I don't know much about her, except she's supposed to be in charge of the Warrior's Hall with Odin. She is, yeah. Her ceremonial title is Queen of the Vanir, though that doesn't mean a lot nowadays. She's also goddess of medicine, in charge of medical affairs in the capital. It's her power that raises the dead and heals the wounded of Valhalla after each day's fighting. He paused, thinking over how to say what came next. I've known her all my life, and she's generally a decent, compassionate person, but she's got problems. Dare I ask what kind of problems? How familiar are you with Norse mythology? They didn't get everything right, but it's as good a starting point as any. Anne considered this. Well, I've been studying some of it, but I've been taking it with a really healthy grain of salt. If nothing else, your mom and Aunt Belle don't really seem to match the stories. At least not that I've seen. They have dimensions you haven't seen. But you're right, there's a lot of stuff that's wrong. Corbin chuckled. I mean, it'd take a pretty warped imagination to take Aunt Erd for a crone. But anyway, one of the places Freya turns up is the story of an, unpleasant incident involving a necklace. I think I remember a little bit of that. She saw it and wanted it, and then traded it for something? Or it got stolen? I couldn't find any really good sources on Norse mythology on a quick search of the library, just kids' stuff that had the details taken out of it, so I didn't study it too hard. Suppose it's not surprising that it got edited. The usual version is that she came upon four Nidavellim, underdwarves, working on a necklace one day, was overcome by wanton greed, and bought it from them at the price of a night with each of them. Anne blinked. Oh, yeah, that would definitely, that's a pretty astonishing load of greed there. Didn't she realize how painful that was likely to be? Corwin shook his head, looking grim. I said that's the usual version. What the usual version leaves out is that those four dwarves didn't just happen to be there, they were waiting for her, and the necklace was bewitched by a Svartelven wizard. The whole thing was a setup. Anne's face darkened. Oh, that's not good. She must have some awful post-traumatic stress problems. Was there anybody in Asgard to help her get over it, or has she been walking wounded ever since? She tried to keep it a secret, but Loki found out about it and told her husband, Odur. Only he left out the same part the sagas leave out. Odur couldn't take it. He resigned his post as god of the sun and left town the very next day. Nobody's seen him since. Freya spent a long time looking for him, but eventually she gave up and came home. Most people don't know why Odur left her, only that it had something to do with the necklace she always wears. Gah, Anne said. She should have told him. Keeping stuff secret like that always comes back to bite you on the ass later. Better to get it out in the open and done with. But what has this got to do with her asking Frey to haul you back to Asgard? Well, see, when Odur left her, Freya was still convinced that she had, incomprehensible as it was, agreed to pay the dwarves' price for her necklace. She didn't find out about what had really happened until sometime later, when Odin learned it and told her. He shrugged. Granddad was probably trying to help, but all it really did by that point, with all the damage done, was convert some of her self-loathing into a complete and irrational hatred of Svartelves. All Svartelves. Anne gave him a look of dawning horror. Anthy. She was trying to hurt Anthy? Gods, I hope nobody ever tells Utrina that one. Well, not just that, Corwin said. See, it started when she learned about, you know, Enthi and me last June. She thought that by calling me back to Asgard and sealing the borders, she would hurt Enthi and everyone who associates with her, everyone who doesn't hate her as much as Freya does, but in a weird way, Freya also thought she was helping me. Because you were falling under some evil Svartalfheim witch's spell? I suppose if I put myself in an awful racist mindset, I could see the logic in that. I guess. Anne shook herself. Damn. Corwin rubbed at the back of his neck. Something like that. She thought she could save me from making her mistakes. Mind you, I didn't know any of that until November. How did you find out? Anne asked. She told me, Corwin replied with a shrug. When Utina and Enthi got into that jam on the Klingon homeworld, I pressed Frey to reduce the alert and let me go help them. He refused. We had words. Anne chuckled darkly. Huh, I'll bet. Afterward, I went home to figure out some way of sneaking out, since he wasn't going to let me go, and Freya stopped by. It was weird. Anne gave him a curious look. How weird? Corwin considered not answering the door. How could a person be expected to do any decent scheming with company calling? But manners and curiosity won out. It might be Frey coming to announce that he'd reconsidered, though Corwin tended to doubt it. That was indeed not the case, though he hadn't been too far wrong in guessing who it might be, anyway. The caller revealed when he opened his apartment door was Freya Lightwalker. As always, she looked calm and restrained, her long, platinum-blonde hair drawn back just so. The intricate golden filigree of her famous necklace, Brisingamen, nestled just below the hollow of her throat. Corwin, slightly surprised to see her there, mustered a cordial nod. Lady Freya. Freya stepped inside, forcing him to step back to avoid being collided with, and shut the door behind her. Her eyes were as cool as the rest of her, but there was a hint of a spark behind them as she said, "You were quite harsh with my brother today. I don't appreciate people treating him that way." Corwin gave her an irritated look. "Well, I don't appreciate him interfering with my life just to advance whatever paranoid agenda he has. There's no need for a damn Class A alert in Asgard. It's ridiculous. He's doing it to pin me here, just to spite me for opening Sephiroth." Freya smiled slightly. "You really believe that, don't you?" "Do you have a more plausible explanation?" Corwin shot back. "That song and dance routine he keeps giving the rest of the Aesir Council about securing Asgard's borders during the crisis in Midgard is bull, and everybody knows it. They just don't want to embarrass him publicly by calling him on it. You're his sister. What the hell's his problem? I never would have believed that he could be so petty." She shook her head. "He's not," she said. "Truth be known, he doesn't believe in the reasons he puts forward for the alert either." She took a step closer. "He never has." "Well then, what the hell?" Corwin began. And Freya leaned close to him, surprising him enough that he didn't finish the question. "He did it as a favor to me," Freya said quietly, and then, to Corwin's considerable shock, she kissed him. So startled was he, in fact, that he made no appreciable response for several busy seconds. Not until he felt a draft and realized she had unbuttoned his shirt while working on him did he snap out of his shocked reverie, put up a hand, and shove her away, a little more roughly than he really needed to. "Hold it, hold it," he said. He wiped his mouth on the back of a sleeve, shook his head, and then demanded, "What the hell, Freya?" "I would have thought that was obvious," Freya replied. Her eyes were smoldering now, but there was something in their light that made Corwin uneasy. This whole situation made him uneasy. He regarded her skeptically. "You've never given indication one that you've been interested in me my entire life, and Granddad knows some of the other ladies around here have never been bashful about it, and all of a sudden you're stopping by for a snog?" She took another step toward him. "Is that so hard to believe? Half the women in Asgard and Vanaheim would trade much for the opportunity." Corwin snorted. "Half the women in Asgard and Vanaheim aren't members of the Aesir Council," he said sardonically. Then, sobering a bit, he added, "Besides, I'm not interested." "Why not?" Freya asked. "Why are you so determined to return to Midgard, Corwin? You've nothing to go back to, not really." Corwin scowled. Freya gave a mirthless chuckle. "You think I don't know? Everyone knows. Many of us would help you mend your broken heart if you only gave us a chance, but instead you insist on always returning to she who broke it." Corwin folded his arms. "That's my business," he said. Freya's eyes flashed more openly now. "Damn you, boy. Why does it have to be them? You could have any of the Valkyrie. Hell, you could have all the Valkyrie. 2 for each day of the week and 3 on Saturday and Sunday." Corwin wanted to laugh at her phrasing, but he couldn't. The whole situation was too weird. It didn't get any less so when Freya started unfastening her tunic and added in a lower, softer voice, "You could even have me." He took a step toward her then, reached for her, and to her obvious dismay, refastened the shoulder tab she'd opened. "I think you should leave," he said. Freya glared at him for a second, then stepped back and shook her head. "Fine," she said. "I tried the carrot, now the stick. Corwin, I will not permit you to carry on your dalliance with the witch. Bad enough you've gotten a child on her." Corwin's face went still, his eyes very cold. "That's what this is about," he said when he could trust himself to speak. "You disrupted the lives of thousands over that? It's not even your concern." "It is my concern," Freya snapped. "I won't have one of the Aesir lowering himself in such a manner. Better for you to consort with mortals than carry on with a black elf witch and her thrall." "Speak carefully, Freya," said Corwin slowly, his voice low. "My patience is not infinite." Wow, some part of him thought. When I get pissed off in Asgard, I talk like Amanda Dessler. Freya smiled, the venomous fury erased from her visage in an instant and replaced with the sunny friendliness of a gentle goddess. "It's very simple, young Ravenhair," she said. "Forsake the witch. Swear you'll never speak to her again, or I'll see to it that you never leave the Golden City. Agree to these terms, and you'll at least see your mortal family again." Her smile became warmer, more intimate. "And we've already spoken briefly of the other rewards that might be yours. What say you, Engine Watcher?" Corwin's brand flickered, glowing from within with the force of his restrained anger. "Get out," he said, his voice hoarse. Freya's smile vanished. "Why must you be so stubborn?" she said. "Just like your mother. It's a simple thing I ask of you. She's not even really your lover, and her consort never can be. One would think you might have learned to live with that by now." Corwin didn't rise to the bait a second time. He almost did, but then something in her eyes caught his attention and distracted him from his own fury. "Why?" he asked. Freya blinked. "What? Why are you doing this?" Corwin asked. "What did Anthy ever do to you?" Freya's expression was pure scorn. "She's a night elf. They don't belong here. They can't be trusted." Leaning toward him, her eyes intense, she hissed, "Decent people do not consort with them." Corwin looked back at her, his anger mostly replaced by an uncomprehending compassion. "What happened to you?" he asked softly. Freya looked rattled. "Nothing," she said, too hastily. Corwin's expression made it clear he didn't believe her. "Nothing doesn't leave attitudes like that behind." "Don't presume to look into me, Machine Lord," Freya said coldly. "I'm not one of your clockwork contraptions, to be mulled over and adjusted. Swear what I require, and you may go." Corwin shook his head. "Never." "Then you will never leave the city," Freya said flatly. The young Ys cracked a tiny, dark smile. "Try and stop me." Freya narrowed her eyes. "If you insist." Frey walked purposefully down the corridor of Corwin's apartment building, intent on discussing the afternoon's events further with the younger god. Perhaps now that they'd both had time to cool off a little bit, they could talk the matter over reasonably. He meant to knock, but the door was ajar, and his blow swung it open to reveal Corwin and, of all people, Freya in his kitchen, looking for all the world like they were squaring off for battle. "Freya, what are you doing?" Frey demanded. Freya turned, saw him, and said in an entreating tone, "Tell him, my brother. Tell him he'll never leave Asgard if he doesn't do as I say." The god of security blinked, entirely baffled. "What?" Without taking his eyes off Freya, Corwin said, "Frey, you better get your sister home before someone gets hurt. I don't know what's the matter with her, but she shouldn't be roaming around loose." Frey scowled. "Mind your tongue, youngster. I'll be back to discuss this with you." Then, approaching his sister, he put a hand on her shoulder and said in a gentle voice, "Come, Freya, you need to rest." "No," Freya protested, her voice becoming shrill. "He has to promise. He has to swear." A moment later, the two were gone, vanishing in a ripple of silvery light. Corwin stood where he was for a moment, then let Stick disappear and slumped with the release of tension. "Beer," he said after a few moments, then turned to his fridge and rummaged within it. Frey returned a few minutes later, looking subdued and embarrassed, and found Corwin on his living room sofa. "I'm sorry you had to see that," he said. "May I sit?" Corwin waved him to the corner armchair, then surprised him by sliding a bottle of Newcastle Brown across the coffee table to him once he was seated. "What's her problem?" he asked. Frey hesitated. "It's personal," he said. "Frey," Corwin said, fixing him with a level gaze, "I just learned that she had you recall everyone and seal the borders of Asgard specifically to mess with my life." With quiet vehemence, he added, "I think I deserve to know what the fucking motivation was." Frey regarded the young Ys for a few moments, then took a pull of his beer, sighed heavily, and sat back in the chair. "All right," he said. "I'll tell you." So he did. Corwin absorbed the information silently, thoughtfully. He knew parts of it already. They were common lore. But the details he hadn't known changed the entire picture. "That's terrible," he said. "I'm sorry for her. But it doesn't excuse her behavior, or yours. You've blatantly misused your authority, Frey. Surely you see that." Frey released another heavy sigh. "I do," he admitted. "But for my sister's peace of mind, I thought it would be a passing fancy. I misjudged the depth of her hatred." Corwin regarded him, not unsympathetically, for a few moments. Then he said, "Now what?" Frey regarded the edge of the coffee table glumly for a moment, took another drink, and then met Corwin's eyes. "Now I must ask of you a favor." Corwin's expression replied, "I'm listening." "I can reverse the alert. At this point, there seems little reason not to. But I ask you to give me time. If what I've done is exposed, I'll be relieved of my place on the council. I don't ask for myself," he added, holding up a hand, "but because my responsibilities would fall on Heimdall's shoulders, and he already carries burden enough." "That still might be better than leaving you in charge if you're so easily convinced to abuse your power," Corwin observed. Frey looked mildly, but only mildly, offended. "I am a faithful steward, Corwin. You know that's true. What I've done was wrong, yes, but I made an error of judgment for love of my sister. Surely that's something a man like you can relate to." Corwin disliked his presumption, but he had to acknowledge that he was right. "How much time?" he asked. "First, I'll need to calm Freya down, make her see that it's for the best, that the charade can't be continued indefinitely," Frey said. "I think her own remarks made her see that what she did, what she had me do for her, was wrong. That's why she became so angry. It'll take me some time, but I think I can make her peaceful again. After that, I'll need to coordinate the lifting of the alert so that it doesn't appear as if I'm simply dropping the matter without cause. After all the defense of the measure I've done to the rest of the council, that would seem strange." Corwin nodded pensively. "How much time?" he repeated. "I think I can have everything arranged so that you can return home in time for the new year," Frey said. Corwin came out of his seat. "The new year? Frey, people I love are in danger right now." "I know," Frey said, "but the law is the law. Even if I were to drop the whole matter right now, it would take several days for all the mechanisms of a Class A alert to unwind themselves. Such is the way the Aesir Council has structured the law." "Then I'll—" Corwin began, but Frey cut him off. "As an Aes," he said in a slow, thoughtful voice, "your first duty is to the Council. But as a man, your first duty is to your family." Frey shook his head. "I won't be the one to force any man to make such a choice. I'll let you go. I'll even compound my crimes and help you go. But it will have to be discreet."